The Trumpet Daily Program begins right now.
Today's world news, what it means, where it's taking us.
I bring you the one and only possible message of world peace.
This is a message of hope, tremendous hope. And he said unto me, you must prophesy again.
The Trumpet Daily Program begins right now.
Hello and welcome to the Trumpet Daily Radio Show. This is Richard Palmer standing in for your regular host, Mr. Stephen Flurry. As usual, there's lots of different events going on around the world. I can't really help but start by talking about some of the new coronavirus rules and regulations that are coming into force now here in the UK. What we're seeing here, I know it's just hard to believe. It's so crazy in a lot of ways. But I think there's also an important lesson that we can learn, that even those of you not in the UK can learn from what we're going through. Now, over here, UK coronavirus deaths are at an official or at a record low. The BBC had an article on that just yesterday. The latest figures show that just 1% of all deaths going on in the UK right now are coming because of coronavirus. And that's about the lowest since records, or since the coronavirus really took off back in March, some of those lowest figures anyway. But you wouldn't know that if you were listening to what the government's saying, to what the BBC is saying and some of the other media. We're going into what's pretty close to being full lockdown mode. There's the rule of six that's come into force recently. No more than six people can be gathered together, and they're doubling the fine for those that disobey that. They're forcing pubs to close at 10 p.m., calling in the army to help the police enforce some of these rules, or at least, you know, having police enforce civil laws in the UK or laws against civilians is very, very illegal. So I think that for now they're just going to have them take over some like guard duty and that kind of thing. But to free up police, to police this. And here in the UK, we're almost unique in doing this. You look, you know, the government is telling us, well, we've got to do this, otherwise we'll end up like France, we'll end up like Italy. You look at France, and France isn't doing any of this. According to the French media, on Friday, they were having a meeting in France. Emmanuel, they were asking about having tougher lockdown laws, and Emmanuel Macron slapped them down. He told the health minister wanted a tougher lockdown. He told the health minister, get back to me when you've done a better job. They're not having any of it over there. But almost uniquely, Britain, and then, well, you see the same thing kind of going on in Australia as well. We're going into more and more of these lockdowns. And you see the government doing more and more now to clamp down on protests. James Dellingpole had an article. This was even before some of those strict lockdown laws came into force. Boris goes full fascist against lockdown protests. He wrote, under Johnson's disastrous premiership, Britain is enforcing a bizarre and unjust authoritarianism where genuinely malign forces, such as Extinction Rebellion and Black Lives Matter, who even managed to blockade Oxford Circus on Sunday, get treated with kid gloves, while peaceful lovers of liberty, like the anti-lockdown, anti-mask demonstrators in Trafalgar Square on Saturday, are maligned, misrepresented, and ruthlessly crushed with arrests, brutal and swinging fines. So he's talking about just over the weekend, you had two different protests. You had the anti-lockdown protest going on Saturday in Trafalgar Square. The next day, Black Lives Matter came along and shut down a very busy road with protests. But the police were very aggressive in clearing one protest out and did basically nothing for the other. And I think you know exactly which way round that goes. He writes, why then is it one rule for the nasties, bullies, thugs, saboteurs, and economic terrorists in the first two groups, but another for the fundamentally decent, law-abiding, freedom-loving members of the public in the third group? And he just talks about how the views within the Conservative Party are far closer in tune with Black Lives Matter and Extinction Rebellion than it is with those that, you know, don't want the army going around enforcing who they have round to their house. He just talks about this effort to crush the lockdown movement. He talks about some of the things that we've seen in Australia, which we've spoken about on this show, And he says, it looks like the United Kingdom is heading that way too. Anyone who wants to protest against this assault on liberty ought to be ready for the worst. He said the police are now a political instrument and they're not afraid to send in the dogs and the riot police thugs to enforce this authoritarian regime's iron will. That was his take on the contrast of the protests over the weekend. And in some ways, I think the lockdown laws are so extreme, so at odds with the evidence that people are starting to wake up. The government published an infamous graph. Monday, I guess it was, to try and support their lockdown laws. It's been pretty widely mocked. There we go. We've got it up on the YouTube stream now, where they said, "Well, this is not a prediction, but this is what could happen if cases keep doubling every 2 weeks." There's absolutely nothing. For those that can't see it, there's this blue version of the graph that is kind of bobbling along and increasing slowly. Then there's a slight decrease, and then the cases just take off like a rocket, and it's completely disconnected. There's nothing in the past data to give you any indication that COVID cases are going to take off like a rocket. But it says, well, this is what happens if they could. And it's saying, well, we could have 50,000 new cases by the middle of October, which is 10 times more than we had at the height of the coronavirus crisis back in March, April. And so this is their justification for locking people down. And it's entirely fictitious. Even the government advisors had to admit that, well, this isn't a forecast. But we still need to lock down just in case this is what happens. It's crazy, but it means you're getting more and more things like this. This is a radio interview from Nick Ferrari here in the UK on clip one.
Listen, respectfully to these people, they told us there was no need to wear a mask, then we should wear a mask. We can go back to our place of work, now we shouldn't go back to our place of work. We can go meet our families, now we can't meet our families. Why should we listen to a word they say?
Well, I really agree with this. What we did was, what's happened is we lost the trust of the public by not being open, by not being transparent, by always trying to manipulate the figures. Let's face it, we had the worst death rates of any European country, even when it was 41,500. And that was when we took, 5,000 off, simply because we wanted to say we'd only count those that died within 28 days of COVID. But you can't have a public trusting you if you don't actually remain open and transparent with them.
But Maggie, 50,000 cases by mid-October, that's 10 times the worse it was in April. You're honestly telling me that the rule of six, the fact that 8 or 9% of us seem to have kind of antibodies, that in fact we are better, we do wash our hands every... You're still telling me that it will be 10 times worse than its peak earlier this year. Come on, these numbers are ludicrous. They're just made up.
But they're only a modelling estimate if we continue to have...
So we're closing down a country on a modelling estimate, lastly. Maggie,
no,
this is
not,
nuts.
No, we're not closing down a country. I think that's, if it were me, I would...
If we were running pubs now, we'd be ringing our bank manager in fear.
Hold on. They are trying. If they'd been open and transparent with the public, perhaps people would actually go with it, which is why I think there's so much resistance. I think what they're trying to do is actually modify what they're doing to try and slow down the transmission. The transmission is going up. You can't deny that.
No, I don't.
I'm not suggesting that it's going to where they guesstimate it could go if we don't do something. So we do need to do something.
I agree with
that's the type of thing that you're getting on UK media. Some more of these much more boisterous discussions than we've had in times past. People starting to object more and more. I guess not on the BBC, but on some of these media sites. To these kind of lockdowns. But if you look to politics, if you look to, well, which leaders are actually having a problem with these kind of lockdowns, there really is no end in sight for the UK. And I think this is one of the big lessons I've taken from especially just the last few weeks, and one that you can take from it no matter where you are in the world. I'll get into what that lesson is. We talk a fair bit about the book of Isaiah, especially the first few chapters recently, because they just so perfectly describe what we're seeing in our nations today. For example, just Isaiah chapter 1 and talks about the whole head being sick, a sinful nation, a people laden with iniquity. The whole head is sick, and the whole heart is faint from the sole of the foot even unto the head. There's no soundness in it. It talks, your country is desolate, your cities are burned with fire, which is what we see in all of the riots today. And it's a great description of what is going on in Britain, what is going on in America. So what's the solution to this? What can you do when the whole head is sick, when the whole heart is faint, when a freedom-loving nation, or that once claimed to be a freedom-loving nation, starts descending into a kind of fascist dictatorship in a lot of ways? Well, where do you go? Well, the next chapter, chapter 2, tells us, and it describes things getting worse and worse. It describes a very prosperous nation in chapter 7, in Isaiah 2 and verse 7, with all of this gold and silver, neither is there any end to their treasures. And then punishments come. Curses come. And you get to the end of the chapter, and you see what the solution is to these problems that we see all around us. Cease you from man whose breath is in his nostrils, for wherein is he to be accounted of? And I don't think this has ever been clearer than it is now, especially in the UK. I think it really teaches that lesson. Cease you from man. If my hope was in man right now in the UK, I'd probably be despairing. Where is the hope if you're looking for a human being to come in there and save the day? Where's the hope for the UK right now? I can't point to a single senior politician with a kind of sound-minded approach to the coronavirus. There's no one that I can say, well, this person who has a reasonable chance of becoming prime minister, he could get in and he could fix this. I think there's about 3 people in Parliament of over 600 that are really opposed to the lockdown. Now, there are more that would like to see, say, more scrutiny of some of these lockdowns, or maybe disapprove of 1 or 2 measures. But there's not many in Parliament that don't like this. Now, there are some people that are turning around and waking up now. Nigel Farage, he had an article yesterday after the new measures were announced called "For Britain's Sake, We Need to Fight This Lockdown Tyranny." Definitely the strongest language we've heard from him the whole time. He concluded his article saying, "I'm sure I'm not alone in saying that we've now reached the point where the cure has become worse than the disease itself." Well, I don't know about now reaching that point. We've been saying that all the way through. And he says, "Nobody voted for this. It's up to us all to fight against this tyranny." That's the kind of language that we're seeing more and more in the UK. But then, there's no path for Nigel Farage to become prime minister. If your hope is in man and for someone like that to step up and fix it, it's just not going to happen. There's no way really for Nigel Farage to come along and be prime minister and start doing this. Just about all the politicians that before I kind of thought were pretty good, well, they're all in favor of the lockdown and calling out the army and all of this. Polls show that most of the public support the lockdown. They want harsher measures. Now, I don't really believe the polls, I have to say that. They've been so wrong in the past. There is even more evidence coming out today that some of the big polls on this are being manipulated, are incorrect. But it's undeniable that a lot of people still are all in favor of the lockdown. There's a lot of people that aren't opposed. There are still a lot of people that support, and we can quibble over exact percentages. And like I said, I think the polls are maybe probably exaggerating those, but there's still a whole lot of people in this country that want more lockdown. They think it's the government's job to wrap them in a big ball of cotton wool and keep them safe. And if that means locking everything down, fine. Kenneth Minogue had a great book I've dug out a bit into. I meant to bring some quotes with me, but it's probably for the best that I didn't, so I've got other material I want to get into. But it's called The Servile Mind. He was writing years ago, and he was tracing back this condition of people giving up their rights so that the government will keep them safe back decades, back before World War II even, and how this mindset was even affecting Britain in World War II. We'll give up our rights if you keep us safe. That's been Britain's thinking for decades. So it's no wonder that this is how we've reacted to this crisis. I mean, I was surprised, but in hindsight, I probably shouldn't have been. It's deeply ingrained in the national thinking now. So even if we could, even if you could somehow magically parachute Nigel Farage into number 10 Downing Street, make him prime minister, well, I think most people still want some kind of a lockdown, or at least aren't opposed to a lockdown. How do you deal with that? You can't reset a nation's mindset overnight that's been decades in the making. That's not something easy to deal with. And then there's the finances. And we destroyed our economy. We don't see it yet, but we have destroyed our economies in Britain and America. Our debt has shot up trillions. In America, you have these bailouts where it's the largest bailout ever. And then it comes along just a few weeks later with another largest bailout ever. America's at debt levels that it's not seen since World War II. But, unlike, you could say, well, America coped with it in World War II. They brought that debt level down. But, there was a very clear point when the war ended, when all that expenditure stopped. And even if you stopped all corona expenditure tomorrow, America's still borrowing more money. It's not in a position to pay all that extra debt back. And after World War II, America was the only major economy left intact. Everybody else's factories were all in rubble. You had the economy boom. It was relatively easy to launch into prosperity after that. That's not going to happen after coronavirus. You'll have this epic level of World War II level debt that's just going to keep rising and rising. And then there's the money printing. I've been amazed more people haven't been talking about what is going on with the money printing. We started with quantitative easing, with money printing, basically, after the 2008 financial crisis. But then we did it carefully. We went into it, and central bankers went into it thinking, okay, we know that this is dangerous. We know that you can wreck economies and impoverish entire nations through money printing. We think it's a good idea for this, but we'll kind of dip our toe in cautiously, and we'll make a bunch of rules that dictate how we spend this money. And we'll be pretty careful with our money printing. And I still think that we would see negative consequences of what they did after the 2008 financial crisis eventually. But what's happened now is kind of this view, well, we got away with it after 2008. And so they're printing money much less cautiously, with reckless abandon. The printing presses are going, the governments are creating more money dramatically faster than they did in the 2008 crisis. Britain is printing money and just handing that straight to the government to spend. Technically, it's a loan that they have to pay back to the Bank of England. But that was forbidden after the 2008 financial crisis. Britain and America decided they were not going to work like that. There wasn't going to be any printing of money and being handed directly to the government. They'd give it to banks first instead. No major government has done this in modern times. Printing money and just handing it straight to the government. It's just considered way too dangerous. And so we're storing up disaster that way. What's the human solution for all of this? In America right now, I think it is easier to trust in man, to hope in man. And President Trump is doing a pretty great job on coronavirus. I wish we had him here, or someone that had his kind of courage. I think over here, there's just a lot of politicians that are terrified of a media that might turn around and say, you didn't lock everything down. All of these deaths are on you. You're a mass murderer. They're too scared of that to do anything. President Trump isn't scared of the media. He's willing to make the right decision, regardless of some of this criticism. So I think it could be, but because of that, it can be easier to trust in man, to look to a human solution, to say, well, he can save our nation. He's going to turn it all around. And he is turning things around to a great extent, and he is saving the nation to an extent, but it's only temporary. It's not a permanent hope. He hasn't got the permanent solutions for the United States. Now, sooner or later, in America and everywhere else in the world, you'll be in the same position that we are in the UK. That's what Isaiah 2 is talking about. Going through all of this suffering, all of these events that happen, and then this is what people learn by the end of it. Cease you from man. That's what the whole world is going to learn. You think just about some of the problems America's facing. Mr. Flurry talked about the new history program and curriculum that President Trump is pushing. And it's great. It's fantastic. There's so much to like about finally somebody stands up to this Black Lives Matter movement and this movement that just completely distorts history. But at the same time, President Trump has got, what, 4 more years left at the most? He's not going to undo the results of 40 years of indoctrination in that time. You know, how do you turn around this far left communist thinking that's just embedded in so much of society? He's going to make, and is making, a big difference temporarily, but he hasn't got the permanent long-term solutions for America. And I'm not saying this just to try and crush people's hope and say, no, just despair. There's no hope. But instead, it is important to understand that any hope in man will sooner or later come to nothing. If that is where our hope is invested in, we will be disappointed. We will despair. But Isaiah 2 verse 22 is the lesson God is teaching the whole world. If we invest our hope in man, it will be crushed. We'll be left hopeless. We need to cease from man, for wherein is he to be accounted of? The solution is to invest our hope in God. He is the one that will solve our problems. Pretty soon the world will see he's the only one that he can. Mr. Flurry has a whole chapter on this in the Jeremiah booklet and talking about Jeremiah chapter 17. And you can get that booklet for free on our website, thetrumpet.com. We're more than happy to send you a free print copy of any of those booklets. But there's a whole chapter in there called No Trust in Man. And I didn't write down the title, actually. I think that's the title, just from memory. Even if you don't have the whole print copy of that book, you can go and just read even that chapter on our website. And it's a fantastic chapter for making this point. It begins, everywhere we look, there are problems man has not been able to solve. We're living cursed lives and usually do not know it. Jeremiah 17 gets at the very heart of why we refuse to face and conquer our problems. This chapter gets to the core of the whole Bible message. That's how important this is. Where we put our hope. It gets to the core of the whole Bible message. Jeremiah 17 and verse 5 said, cursed be the man that trusts in man and makes flesh his arm and whose heart departs from the law, from the Lord. If that's where our hope is, we're under a curse. Jeremiah 17 and verse 9, the heart is deceitful above all things and desperately wicked. Who can know it? Mr. Flurry, in that chapter, he said, trusting sick human minds is why we live in such a sick, sick, sick world. The frightening evidence is all around us. Avoiding human annihilation is our number one problem. That one problem should reveal how sick the human mind is. He talked about how the Pharisees failed to see their own sick minds. They put their trust in themselves and in man. And he said, this is the number one problem of humanity today. People don't see their own terminal sickness. They don't see the need for a physician, the real Jesus Christ, not a false Christ. But soon people will be in a nuclear holocaust created by sick human minds. Then God will be able to teach them because they'll not be able to deny the fruits of their human reason. Understanding this profound verse, Jeremiah 17 verse 9, is more important than any education in this world. When we understand it, radical action is necessary. The greatest need is to understand God, to let him reveal our own sickness and heal it. So this teaches that Jeremiah 17 teaches us a fundamental lesson about trusting in human minds to solve our problems. But it also gives us this same chapter a sure source of hope. Jeremiah 17 and verse 7. It says, blessed is the man that trusts in the eternal, whose hope the eternal is. If that's where we put our trust, well, then we're going to be blessed. For he shall be as a tree planted by the waters that spreads out her roots by the river and shall not see when heat comes, but her leaf shall be green and shall not be careful in the year of drought, neither shall cease from yielding fruit. So when times get hard, the person whose trust is in God, he doesn't have to worry about that. There can be a heat and a drought, but that person's leaf will be green. He'll prosper still. And I have to wonder a bit, well, maybe part of the fact I'm kind of so frustrated and aggravated by some of what's happening in the UK, is a sign that I'm not doing this enough, that I don't have enough of my hope in God and in the future, that I'm kind of investing too much, even still in this present evil world. Hoping too much, or putting too much of that hope still in man. Now, you know, God does want us sighing and crying for our nations. He doesn't want us seeing our nations going and getting into trouble and being indifferent or gleeful about it. But that, you know, if our trust is in God, there will always be a fundamental hope and joy. I said, I think if we get overly frustrated, and I'm thinking about this one myself, well, maybe that is a sign that we need to put more hope in the future, have that future be more real to us than the present world that we see around us, and not look for solutions to come from this present world, because they're not going to be there. So Jeremiah chapter 17, it also has a wonderful promise. You know, invest your hope in God. He will take care of you. He will protect you. Now, it's a living hope. If our hope and faith is in God, we're going to take action. It's not a case of just kind of sitting back and doing nothing and saying, well, yep, I'm hopeful God's going to take care of all of my problems and all the world's problems. You know, if we're trusting what God says, we're going to be doing what he says. We're going to be following through and saying, well, he says this way of life leads to blessings. I'm putting my trust and my hope in God. I'm following that way of life. But this is the only source of real and living hope, and that's what we need to remember as we see some of these frustrating bits of news around us. Like I said, I think Britain's news is especially frustrating right now, but that's coming to a lot more countries around the world. And it's certainly not only Britain. I think you look at some of the Philippines and Australia, and there's plenty of places that have it worse really than we do here in the UK. I don't mean to kind of get up here and say we've got it worse than anywhere else in the world. You know, that's not true. There's still a lot of blessings here. But this, for all of us, is where we need our hope. Well, we'll take a quick break and we'll talk about another important set of pieces of news, another potential false hope, and the real hope behind it. We'll be right back.
This is KPCG-FM, and this is the Trumpet Daily. Freedom is one of the most sought-after ideals in human history. Man's search for freedom has taken him into the fiercest of protests, struggles, revolutions, civil wars, even world wars. Today, in the midst of free societies, many continue to fight for what they perceive as ever greater freedoms. And yet, many of these same people are actively fighting against law. Few people understand that this war against law actually undermines true freedom. To learn more, request Gerald Flurry's booklet, No Freedom Without Law. In this free booklet, you will see what the Bible says about the latter-day spirit of rebellion and lawlessness that is now so common in our nations today. Also request America Under Attack. In this booklet, you will learn more about the spirit behind this attack on law. You'll see where this is leading. Both booklets are offered freely at no cost or obligation to you. Request No Freedom Without Law and America Under Attack. Email your request to td@kpcg.fm or visit thetrumpet.com. This is KPCG-FM, and this is the Trumpet Daily.
The radio show. Well, I want to... the news from Britain, the news from America, it does grab our attention very easily. And there are a lot of important stories that we need to be studying over the past couple of days. Mr. Flurry's just been talking about some of the things going on in the Supreme Court. It's a huge story. It's an important story. It ties directly in with the Bible and Bible prophecy. There are important lessons that we need to take away from that. But there are other areas of the world that we really do need to be watching that maybe don't tug on our sleeve quite as hard, screaming for attention. And one of those areas is the Middle East and the area around Jerusalem. Mr. Gerald Flurry had an article a few years ago called Why You Must Watch Jerusalem. And he wrote, Jerusalem is at the core of the eternal plan of God and the key to the future of mankind. But no one seems to care. We can't afford to ignore this special city. We must watch Jerusalem. And he talked in that article about how it's key to so many events that's going on in the world. And he said the human condition is so easily fixated on the pleasures of the present. We are so easily distracted. But he said, watch Jerusalem and watch yourself. Make sure you don't let down. Time is too short. And he said there are many, well, he was talking about some of these news events. He said there are many more details about the shocking chain of event that leads to the coming of the Messiah. But the main takeaway is that Jerusalem is at the heart of it all. It is comforting to know that when the Messiah will come, but this is only a less important physical reason to watch Jerusalem. And there's a lot of reasons to be watching Jerusalem. And one of those reasons is that it does play a major role in what's going on in the world. So I wanted to talk about some events that are going on, that's going on around that region. This is an article from German Foreign Policy earlier this week. It's called Neighborhood on Fire. It's about what the people are talking about in the EU this week. They're having a big summit. And on one of the things on the agenda, a lot of the things on the agenda of this summit revolve around the Middle East. He said, on the agenda is, this article says, on the agenda in particular is how to deal with the war in Libya and the crisis in Lebanon, the Eastern Mediterranean, and Belarus, and countries bordering the Union to the south and to the east. Obviously, Belarus is not in the Middle East, but the other ones are all closely related to that region. To create, and then it talks about, well, I'm reading this from a kind of a translated version out of German, so it's a bit distorted sometimes. But basically, it's saying that back in 2003, Germany talked about, or Brussels, the EU, talked about trying to create a ring of allied states in this area. The European Security Strategy, it said, we must work towards creating a ring of responsibly governed states east of the European Union and on the Mediterranean borders with whom we can maintain close cooperation-based relationships. So that's what they aim to do and have aimed to do for a long time. In 2013, Berlin had an article, a strategy paper, saying that Germany and the EU should primarily focus their external influences, what countries they work with. They should focus on the environment from North Africa via the Middle East to Central Asia. So this whole area, North Africa, Middle East, and then just the other side of the Middle East. That's what Europe knows that it needs to focus on. But notice what they've been saying this week. This is the EU Foreign Affairs Representative, Joseph Borrell. He said, in the past 10 months, our neighborhood from Libya to Belarus has gone down in flames. Everything has gotten much worse than I could have expected. This whole area, it's gone down in flames. It's gotten much worse than I could have expected. He said that there are conflicts that have added to the tensions in the Eastern Mediterranean between Greece and Cyprus. And then Turkey, he said that these conflicts were increasing exponentially with a strong risk of confrontation. And this article just goes on to talk about how Germany's long talked about there being a crisis arc in this area where they need to get more involved in. So that's what Europe is meeting to talk about at the moment. The Middle East is on fire. It's gotten way worse than we anticipated. We need to do something. And then this is another article, I think this was last week, I neglected to write down the date, from Foreign Policy. Macron wants to be a Middle Eastern superpower. So you've got France here dramatically stepping up its efforts in the Middle East, getting much more involved all over the place. The article says, the French are back in the Middle East, or at least it seems that way. With all the talk these days about Russia or China filling the space in the Middle East that the United States is alleged to be vacating, France is now making a bid to be part of that conversation. In the past month and a half, President Emmanuel Macron has visited Lebanon twice, and we've talked a fair bit about that at the Trumpet. We've kind of focused on that link to Lebanon for some very important reasons, but it's more than just Lebanon. It says he's turned up in Baghdad for meetings with President Bahram Saleh, Prime Minister Mustafa al-Kadhimi, the Kurdish regional government's president, Nechirvan Bazini. Macron has also beefed up the French military presence in the area, deploying naval units, including a helicopter carrier and a frigate, to the eastern Mediterranean. And it talks about how he's working closely with the Greek Navy, with Crete, that they're putting more fighter jets now into Cyprus, the French are, and that they've been linking up and doing exercises with the Greek Navy. So you've got Europe worried about an area on fire, saying we need to do more to reach out to countries across the Middle East, from North Africa all the way to Asia. And then you've got Emmanuel Macron and France stepping up, having meetings with all of these different countries. And there's just a couple that I focused on in that quote. The article goes on and just talks about all of these different areas where France is getting more involved and saying, hey, you know, we've been talking about, you know, this article is basically saying, you know, we've been talking about Russia or China taking over the leading role in the Middle East as America leaves. Well, is anybody watching France? Look what they're doing. Maybe actually they'll be the leading power in the Middle East. And this is something that ties in right, you know, directly into some key Bible prophecies, some important Bible prophecies, and even something that Mr. Flurry talks about on the Key of David that's coming up just this weekend. I have a transcript for the upcoming show that should go up on our website on Friday. We'll air on all the different TV channels on Friday and on Sunday, called the Psalm 83 Prophecy. Now, what Mr. Flurry focuses on, what the Bible focuses on, talks about Germany's role in the Middle East. And at the moment, France, maybe they're the ones kind of grabbing the foreign policy headlines. But as Mr. Flurry has drawn attention to, you know, they often work very closely with Germany. And you know, really, if they're trying to replace the United States in the Middle East, they don't have the resources to do that by themselves. They've already, when they were stepping up some of their involvement in North Africa, kind of turned to Germany for that extra help, because they needed a prosperous, powerful country backing them. You know, Germany's got the kind of economic support that France needs. So we'll see Germany playing a bigger role in this, even if, like I said, if France is the one that maybe foreign policy is focusing on as in the more visible one. I think Germany is often pretty willing to not draw as much attention to themselves, whereas Emmanuel Macron kind of much more likes to beat the drum and go around and show off that he's being this big, powerful world influencer. But in that article, he talked about how Germany's prophesied to get more involved than all of these different Middle Eastern nations. He talked about how there's a lot of division in the United States. We're wanting to get more out of the Middle East as Germany gets more and more into it. And they have a lot more unity with those moderate Arabs than you will ever imagine. He says, I'll show that to you today. It's something we really need to understand. We really need to understand this relationship between Europe and the Middle East, especially Germany and the Middle East. But there's a very specific prophecy that just really leaps off the pages of some of those, some of that material from, say, German foreign policy, talking about a ring of instability going around Europe, and Europe trying to get more involved with these nations on its periphery. And that's something called, you could call the whirlwind prophecy, something that Trumpet Editor-in-Chief Gerald Flurry has written a fair bit about. We wrote about it in our booklet, The King of the South. Here's what he wrote there. The Germans are excellent war strategists and warriors. They're savvy enough to know they will never have peace with Iran. They know that sooner or later, their two religions, their two civilizations will clash. And so you can look in Daniel chapter 11, and it talks about this time. And Mr. Flurry is saying there, well, Germany knows that it's coming. You know, maybe they don't know all the details of this prophecy, but they know that there's a clash coming with Iran. They know that they've got this power that's not really all that far away from Europe, certainly much closer than it is to the United States, that threatens all of their trade lanes. And it's an imperialist power, a country that's growing in power, that sponsors all these terrorist nations. So talking about Daniel 11 and verse 40 and onwards, he said, this scripture describes the time when Germany's Catholic Empire will wage all-out war, throwing everything it has at radical Islam, dominating it like a violent flood pouring in. He says, Germany is expected to clash with Iran, and it has been working on a strategy for a decade or more. That strategy is almost complete. Germany has surrounded Iran. And the Bible talks about this happening, says it will happen. Now, you can look, Daniel chapter 11 and verse 40, it says, at the time of the end shall the king of the south or Iran and Mr. Fleury, or radical Islam led by Iran and Mr. Fleury proves that in great detail in that book, The King of the South. The King of the South shall push at him, and the King of the North shall come against him like a whirlwind. Come against him like a whirlwind. What does that mean? Like a whirlwind. And Mr. Fleury says, whirlwind is a very revealing word in this verse. It means to sweep away in a storm. And he talks about how it's got this strong connotation of terror in this attack. There's an unusual emphasis on terror he talks about. But then he also quotes, well, he quotes Songsino commentary saying the King of the North will swoop down. He said this isn't a straightforward assault. It's a storm that whirls around you, a whirlwind, whirling round around, invading the land and flooding into it. It carries connotations of surrounding Iran, coming at them from all directions rapidly. And he says, if you study what's happened in the territory surrounding Iran today, you already see Germany all over it. How exactly has the King of the North surrounded the King of the South? Its troops haven't encircled Iran. It doesn't have bases and aircraft carriers dotting Iran's borders, but it has made some very intelligent, very strategic deployments and deals that give it a presence all the way around Iran's sphere of influence. And he goes through a lot of specifics, talking about all these different deals that Iran has done, or that Germany's done in North Africa, working with Saudi Arabia and then a lot of the Sunni Arab states, and on into the Mediterranean. And it's the same language that we see coming from this European Union report and some of these meetings. You know, this region, it's gone down in flames. And we've got to, we must work towards creating a ring of responsibly governed states east of the European Union and on the Mediterranean borders. So in Eastern Europe, but then also into the on around the Mediterranean, Middle East, North Africa, we need a ring of responsibly governed states. We need to surround this area with responsibly governed states. Or that other report from Germany that that the main focus of the EU, the primary focus of their foreign policy should be on the environment from North Africa via the Middle East to Central Asia. And maybe if the guys could just pull up that map again. You know, if you're talking about North Africa, the Middle East, and East Asia, you know, what are you talking about? You're talking about the countries that are all around Iran. You know, North Africa on the one side of Iran, the Middle East. You're also just to the east of Iran, and then up into Central Asia. Well, now you're on the other side of Iran. They're talking exactly about this same kind of thing that Mr. Fleury was talking about. There's the map. So if you look at North Africa, Middle East, and then into Central Asia, well, yeah, you've got some of those bases and deals with Algeria, on into the Middle East with Saudi Arabia and Turkey, and then getting into Central Asia with Afghanistan, surrounding Iran. Exactly as the Bible talks about. And then France, as part of the German-led King of the North, you know, they're going to play a role in that as well, and they'll probably be lending a whole lot of their power and support to Germany. Like I said, Germany is the main one to watch here, even though France will often steal the thunder. And Mr. Fleury has talked, he has several articles and a Trumpet cover article talking about this close relationship between France and Germany and about how Emmanuel Macron is really empowering Germany. So if France is getting more involved in that region, getting more involved in Libya, sending ships and naval units, helicopter carrier, frigates, stationing fighter planes on Cyprus, you know, they're also coming into this area around Iran. And here you start to see, well, one, just part of the reason why watching Jerusalem is so important from the new standpoint. You know, Germany is setting Daniel 11 and verse 40 up right now already. And Jerusalem is right at the heart of those prophecies in Daniel chapter 11. And you can see what they do after taking out the King of the South. They go right on into Jerusalem. And you can look at the world news and headlines from earlier in this week, quotes from EU officials. They're getting ready for this right now. They're creating alliances and things like that surrounding Iran. They have a strategy. This time where it will be super obvious to everyone that there's no hope in man, that time is nearly here. You know, watch Jerusalem through the lens of Bible prophecy and you see how urgent these times are. How urgently we need to be getting ready and preparing for the future. So, and obviously, as Mr. Flory indicated in that quote, there are some other massive reasons to be watching Jerusalem, not just that. But that's one of the things that we can take from watching this area. It's another crucial trend, though, that I wanted to talk about just quickly from this this part of the world. And this is, you're really seeing some of the biggest challenges NATO has ever faced. Potentially even the end of NATO. Just some headlines from the last few weeks. Germany versus Turkey. Is a war inside NATO possible? This is one article. I forgot to write down where that was from exactly. But this article makes the point. Well, you've got a war brewing here. There's certainly a lot of very aggressive rhetoric going on in this area. You've got the situation here is you've got Turkey is claiming parts of Greek waters. Greece is saying, you can't just come along and take our waters. There's valuable oil and gas, especially natural gas, under the surface of some of these waters in the Mediterranean. And Turkey wants to muscle in and get a slice of that pie. Greece doesn't want to let them have it. And they both have conflicting definitions of who owns which bit of seabed. And it's been getting quite aggressive. They've both been conducting military drills and sailing warships close to each other and all of those things. And this article points out, well, you've had wars between Turkey and Greece before, but now France is coming down very strongly on Greece's side, and you've got the possibility of a war between Turkey and France. And even if not a war, certainly a lot of anger and animosity between the two. And outside of the United States, Turkey and France are two of NATO's biggest, most important military powers. And now they're potentially going, the key members of this alliance are potentially squaring off against each other. And this is already damaging NATO. This article says, at the same time, the United States, as the leader of NATO, is faced with the task of preventing a military conflict between the two members of the alliance. And this task is no longer only internally related. It's not only internal relations within NATO. With his behavior, Erdogan in Turkey is effectively defying America and demonstrating a reluctance to obey. And the whole world is watching the result of this confrontation. In addition, the conflicts between Turkey and Greece calls into question the ability to provide security. If a military clash occurs between the two countries, it will deal a significant image blow to the United States and will certainly shake the partners' faith in NATO. It's already changing what the world views about NATO, changing what the world sees about America, with Erdogan kind of going and doing whatever he wants. Baltic World, they had an article. They were talking to the chief strategy officer at Rasmussen's Global Fabric, chief strategy officer at Rasmussen Global, and his name is Fabrice Polter. And he was talking about the major division between NATO, the rift that this situation was causing. He said the real squeeze for NATO is from the inside. Yes, there are these crises on the outside in Belarus, in the Eastern Mediterranean crisis, some of these crises we've been talking about. But fundamentally, it is squeezed from the inside because some of the big members, the US, Turkey, France, are not seeing eye to eye. I think on the inside of NATO, there is a real political crisis simmering. A real political crisis. Al Monitor, just one more article. Is Erdogan trying to split NATO with his East Med gambit? And he says any collusion between Turkey's warships, or any collision, sorry, between Turkey's warships and the Greek and French naval forces may spell the end of NATO, since all these countries are NATO members. This should not come as a surprise for the French President Emmanuel Macron, who recently said, what we are currently experiencing is the brain death of NATO. Now, France isn't really bothered about the potential for the end of NATO. That's probably why they're so willing to stand up to Erdogan. If it undermines NATO to have these two big NATO allies at loggerheads, well, they don't mind too much. NATO's brain dead anyway. But if these two start fighting off, you could have, it's this article saying, potentially the end of NATO. And I think what is really interesting, or one thing that's fascinating about this, is you look at Germany's role in this confrontation and what some of the things Mr. Flory has said about Germany and NATO. I had a cover article on the Trumpet several years back, Germany and Russia's secret war against America. You may remember the cover. It showed this pipeline running under the sea. And you've probably heard about this pipeline that Germany is building with Russia, that President Trump has been very critical of, and talking about how it undermines NATO. And this is one of the key things Mr. Flurry focused on in this article, is that this pipeline that Russia Germany is building, it shows that they're happy to undermine NATO. They don't mind the end of NATO. That's why they're working so closely with Russia. You know, NATO is meant to protect Germany against Russia. But you know, Germany is quite happy to have that strong relationship with Russia that pipeline creates. And, well, that shows that they're not too concerned about NATO. And he talks about this pipeline and says that it binds Russia and Germany together in a way that undermines NATO. In fact, though Russia and Germany will not say so, this pipeline project is clearly intended to wreck NATO. It's not a bug, it's a feature. They're wanting to wreck NATO. Why would they do that? Well, Mr. Flurry writes, America spent billions raising Germany from the rubble of World War II and billions more keeping the peace in Europe. Germany would not be where it is today without the vast amount of help America supplied. President Trump mentioned this in his remarks. He quote the president talking about how much they're protecting Germany, and Germany's just paying billions to Russia. Mr. Flurry asks, why would Germany be spurning that history? Many elite Germans feel their nation has now gotten all it can from the US and they're ready to move on. Some powerful Germans today are thinking more and more about the Holy Roman Empire, and they want modern Germany to assume more power of its own in the spirit of that empire. They want to establish Europe as a mighty German-led superpower. These Germans know that NATO is an obstacle to their goal. Back when NATO was first founded, its first Secretary General, Lord Ismay, explained that its main purpose was to keep the Russians out, the Americans in, and the Germans down. That notion of keeping the Germans down directly contradicts the imperialistic ambitions that are growing more intense among many elite Germans today. So Germany's not happy with NATO. They're quite happy to see it undermined. They are actively undermining it in their dealings with Russia. And now we're seeing Turkey and France, to a certain extent, undermining NATO as well in the Middle East. And that was the first thing Mr. Flurry got into in that subject, in that article. It undermines NATO, and Germany wants to do it. And then something else that I think is fascinating is in that same article, Mr. Flurry talked about Gerhard Schroeder, this former German leader, and his key role that he has in this Nord Stream pipeline, in this pipeline that undermines NATO. But he also talked about how close this same individual is with Erdogan in Turkey. He talked about how he was present when Erdogan was sworn in for his second tenure as president. He said, people around the world are alarmed by the dictatorial powers Erdogan has been taking on. He said that this dictator commands one of the world's most powerful militaries with no checks on his power. He talked about his anti-Semitism, how much he hates Israel. And then he said, why would Germany want to be officially represented at the inauguration of an anti-Semitic dictator by sending former Chancellor Schroeder there to shake his hand? He said that Schroeder's attendance at this ceremony gives us another chilling glimpse under the surface of Germany's ruling class today. You know, they've got no problem working with Erdogan in Turkey. And today, with this conflict brewing in the Mediterranean, Germany's not doing much to rein Turkey in. People have been kind of surprised that they've not done more to stand up to Turkey. But they seem quite willing just to let Turkey go on and clash with France. Now, are they happy with what's happening at the moment because it undermines NATO and that's what they want anyway? And they're just quite happy to let this conflict go on? I think it certainly seems like that. Now, NATO is the alliance system of the last 70 years. It's already been fading, but it's still a very significant alliance system. You know, no NATO means Western Europe has to look after itself, has to build up its own military, and has to get more involved in the Middle East itself. The EU has a lot of military hardware. If it starts sharing that together in its own framework, it can be very powerful very quickly. And so the fact that Germany thinks they've gotten all they can from NATO, they're ready to throw that off. Well, that's also very revealing about where we are in Bible prophecy. A lot of people think that there's a lot of hope right now for the Middle East with some of these peace deals that are being negotiated.
But really, when you look at what's happening with Europe, the way they're building up this whirlwind prophecy, the way that NATO is being undermined, you know, this hope that we see, it's a mirage. It's not a real hope. And this is one of the things Mr. Fleury focused on, really focuses on in this Key of David, these peace deals that we're looking at. They're not a real hope. They're not a sure hope. Instead, he says, we all need to think about that, because I'll tell you this, there is a peace and there is a hope a million times greater than what they're talking about. What these world leaders are negotiating, that's not a real hope, but God has something a million times later. So again, you know, a lot of people are investing their hope in these Abraham Accords and these peace deals, and we're saying there's no hope there. Not to be killjoys, but because if your hope is in the Abraham Accords and Donald Trump's Middle East peace deals, you're going to be disappointed. It's going to get a lot worse. But Mr. Fleury's Key of David on Friday, do look out for that. That is filled with a real hope. And I'll just quickly mention as we close another source of real hope for this area. We have a new book, The Eternal Has Chosen Jerusalem. It's not out yet. You can't read it online, but you can order your copy so that we send that to you as soon as it's available. I haven't read it yet. I'm very excited to get a copy of that in a few weeks. That has more on why you should watch Jerusalem and the sure hope in that region. That's The Eternal Has Chosen Jerusalem. Like all of our booklets, you can get that on our website for free at thetrumpet.com. Just click on the literature tab at the top right of the screen there. Well, thanks for listening. I believe Mr. Stephen Fleury will be back tomorrow. You can email us at td@kpcg.fm. You can keep listening here at YouTube or 101.3 on the FM dial or at kpcg.fm.